Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings. There has been somewhat of some technical difficulty, so without further ado, I'm going to try to call my guest again, and we can get this show started. Gary Ugarick. Hopefully it will work this time.
Hello. Please state your name after the tone, and Google Voice will try to connect you.
Mac. Okay, it's going to do the same thing.
Hello.
Hello, Gary. For a minute there, I thought I was going to have to start over again.
Oh, no. This time I told you I was on my A game.
Okay, we're on the air, just so you know.
Okay.
And we're live, but I don't have my my little program that I can fix it. So there's like a pause there if you want to tell people that it's there, because it's only like a few seconds, but there's a little bit of a pause because I thought I was going to have to start over again.
No worries. Hey, people, there's a pause, so.
Well, for the recorded version, anybody listening to the live version would know. Okay, so, well, might as well get started. You still get your whole hour, so, you know.
Yay!
So that's good.
Well, that's also dependent on my six-year-old, who's, like, right now tearing up his bedroom just fun.
Somebody must have given him
caffeine.
Well, you know, that's life. I mean, if you need to cut the show short, then you can do that.
Like I said, he's... Until I hear the crying and, Daddy, I got a boo-boo, then I'm good.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you this, the usual question, and I'm looking at something. That's why I'm like, because usually I have this all ready to go, but since I had to start over, I'm like, I have to do this over too, because I wanted to share it online so that people could click on it. So I'm going to ask you the question, and then I'll be listening to you, but I'm also going to be sharing it onto social media so that people can listen. So,
okay, sounds good.
So the question I was going to ask you was, when was it that you decided you wanted to start getting into filmmaking?
Oh, God, that was, I think, as far back as the ninth grade. I just had a fascination with movies. You know, I was one of those kids that was lucky enough to have two VCRs, and this was before copyright protection and Macrovision on VHS tapes. So, you know, I'll go to the video store, rent movies, transfer them over to blank cassettes. So I had this, like, massive catalog of every horror, action, and comedy film that I could get my hands on, and I was just, you know, I probably shouldn't be saying this on the air, but it was 30 years ago. So, well, actually, you know, 40 years ago. Well, hey, how old am I? I'm 50, so 35 years ago. But yeah, I just was fascinated with the whole art of it. You know, it just, you know, I used to buy the Fangoria magazines just so I could read about the making of whatever film they were working on. And, you know, back then we didn't have the internet. So, you know, any magazine you could get that covered a making of or some kind of an interview with the production, you know, it's like, even if you couldn't afford to buy the magazine, the bookstores back then still had the places you could sit and read. So, you know, that's why I kind of felt sorry for, what was it, Borders? Or was it the other one? Barnes and Nobles, that had the cafes and everything, because people never bought books. They just used it as a public library.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I think both of them had that problem.
Yeah, I never bought a book in Barnes and Nobles or Borders. I literally didn't. I've always, you know, when you could start buying them online through Amazon, that's where I was getting my books.
Yeah, well, it was me. It wasn't even an online thing. It was I could get them cheaper elsewhere.
Well, yeah, there's that too. You know, especially bestseller stuff, because I was really into Dean Koontz and, you know, Clancy's, the Jack Ryan series. And then there was, obviously, I was a huge Stephen King fan. And usually you could find that stuff, you know, at your local, you know, back then we had Ames, Hills, James Way, you know, Kmart, you know, and they always had a section of New York bestsellers. So, you know, they were big. I'm not as much of a reader now as I was when I was younger. You know, now that I'm older, I'm just like, can I find a digital version and just skim through it on my computer? So. Yeah, my attention span isn't what it used to be.
Yeah, I love reading. And I love Dean Koontz and Stephen King. And, yeah, I love those guys.
Yeah, I've been I was going to say the last thing that I read was the what the hell is the name of that book? The one that can't remember the name of it. The title of the book, and it's downstairs. But it was the one that Trump's ex press secretary wrote about her time in the White House. That was the last book I bought. Stephanie Grisham, that was her name. Yeah, so I was reading that just because I was curious about how, you know, from a point of view of somebody else, like how crazy things were. It is what it is. Anyways.
Well, actually, that's all very interesting. So now I'm just going to delve right into the movie part. And then we might get to some other stuff that I made notes on. But now you can say as much or as little as you want about any of this. But I'm going to start from what I saw on IMDb, which was in 2005, you played a zombie in Land of the Dead. And in 2006, you were first assistant camera in a short called Under the Bed. Now, if you want to say anything about either one or both of those, go ahead. Yep. And then after that, we'll get into your directorial debut.
Sure. You know, it's kind of funny. When I did George Romero's Land of the Dead, it was because I was hounding Universal when they were remaking Dawn of the Dead back in 03. And I just made a pest of myself, you know, saying, cause I had an online radio station back then, you know, when everybody was into the whole online radio before Blog Talk and all of that. And the name of my online radio station was Wet and Wild Radio. So, but when I'd call Universal, I would just say, hey, I'm WNWR out of Baltimore, Maryland. And, you know, we heard you're remaking Dawn of the Dead. We want to know if, you know, we could talk to somebody in the production, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so they were like, oh, they took my name and number. And they didn't call back within, like, you know, 3-4 days. And I'm sitting there, you know, I called them back again. And the girl goes, oh, you know, she's, I'm sorry, I just got sidetracked. And I said, I just want you to understand, you're remaking one of the biggest horror films in history. And I said, a beloved film. And I said, and the last thing you kind of want to do is keep things under wrap because Romero fans are just rabid. You know, I said, they are very loyal. And I said, you know, it's so finally they got the point and they brought me up to Toronto, got to tour the set, talked to Zack Snyder. And then, you know, they were sending me pictures from the production. I'd put them on my website, and it was ticking off all the major horror websites like Bloody Disgusting and some of the others. They were like, how did you get this? And I said, I made a I made myself a nuisance until Universal finally gave in. So come March of 2004, they're doing the world premiere in Los Angeles, and the girl, Janelle Forte, was the marketing director. And she says, hey, Gary, Universal wants to bring you out to L.A. so you can see you're going to go to the world premiere, but also you're going to go see a private screening the night before. you know, with just the cast and Zach and blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, that's cool. So they flew me out to L.A., and the world premiere was fun, and that's where I met Greg Nicotero, who's a famous makeup effects artist. I mean, I've heard of the guy, but I physically met him in person, and it turns out he was following my website. And then he said, hey, you know, George Romero's moving ahead with his, you know, first zombie film in 20 years. He said, do you want to come back to Toronto and play a zombie? I was like, dude, you that's like asking me, you know, hey, you want $1 million? Of course I want to come up and be a zombie. So that's how I ended up in Land of the Dead. The Under the Bed movie was when I did my first film, Deadlands, The Rising. I had two young kids who were up and coming makeup artists, Scott Simpson and Christian Quarantillo. And they called themselves Spaghetti Industries because they were really into the Italian horror stuff. And so we didn't have a lot of money to make the movie. So I said to them, is there something I can do in exchange? I'll try to give you as much money as I can, but is there something else? And they were like, well, can you help us make a short film? And I said, yeah, sure. And so there was that aspect of it. And then I worked on a very similar film with my friend Lonnie Martin and his wife, Cindy Marie Martin, that was part of the 48-hour film festival. And, you know, God, it's been 15 years. So I don't remember what the outcome was of the competition, to be honest. I don't think we won because there was a guy who was able to get Larry King for his short film, and I think he was the one that won. But, you know, if you've, I'm not sure where you're from, but Blog Talk Radio comes up on my caller ID as New York City. But the Baltimore, Virginia, D.C. area has a very active independent film community. I mean, you can throw a stone in any direction and somebody's shooting a movie, whether it's a short film or a feature, digital feature with like very little budget. And so you just start meeting tons of people. And because we're all broke, well, at the time we were all broke, you know, it's just like, well, if you help me on my film, I'll help you on your film. So that's really how you got things done back then. And that's how I ended up with, you know, those Land of the Dead and Under the Bed under my belt.
Cool. Okay, now you've already mentioned it, but I'm going to go over it for a minute just for the listeners. So Deadlands, The Rising, which was that same year, 2006, and as is quite common in independent filmmaking, you did a lot of stuff, visual effects, editor, composer, producer, writer, director, actor. Now that one I know won some awards. It won at like two different festivals, Best Director, Best Zombie Movie, and Excellence Award, and a couple other ones.
Yeah,
so that was that one.
Yeah, well, I always wanted to make a zombie film. If I ever made a film, I wanted to make a zombie film. And one of the zombie movies that actually inspired me to make a zombie movie, well, there was two. There was George Romero's Day of the Dead and Dan O'Bannon's Return of the Living Dead from 1985. Those two movies alone was like, oh, man, I want to make movies. So when I had the chance, I figured that, okay, I was on the set of Dawn of the Dead. I was on the set of Land of the Dead. I figured one day each, I picked up enough information to at least throw my hat in the ring. You know, I knew it was never going to be perfect. I knew that, you know, it was going to be flawed. It was going to be low budget. It was probably going to be ridiculed by everybody on the internet. I didn't care. I was just like, and there was some forums that actually tore the movie apart when I released a trailer. And, you know, I went in and I was just like, you know, I'm reading their comments and I'd sign up and say, oh, you know, I was like, okay. And, you know, and they're like, oh, you should quit your day job. And I was like, well, how many of you have, you know, put up 10 grand of your own money and went and tried to make a movie? And like, nobody would reply. So, but yeah, we, It was myself, my best friend Brian, his wife Michelle. We had tried to have their son Lane in the movie, but during the when the mother and the child are escaping the house to get in the car and take off, they were moving a little slower than I expected, and the zombies were able to reach the car just as they got in, and they started shaking the car violently, and it scared the hell out of Lane, and he was only like 7 or 8 at the time, and he just freaked out. He didn't want to do it anymore. So my friend Lisa had a son about the same age named Connor, and Connor's like, I'll do it. And I'm like, well, I ain't got nobody else. So yep, you're the new kid. But yeah, you want to fly by the seat of your pants stuff. The biggest thing that I think the reason Deadland kind of did well, and I'm not trying to tug my own chain here, is in the middle of the movie, once the you know, things start hitting the fan, I closed off a 4-lane road in a city I lived in Maryland, which is near impossible to do. I begged the city of Gaithersburg, Maryland. I said, look, the road dead ends because you're working on the bridge. You took the bridge out. I said, nobody's using it. I said, I'm going to shoot from like 10 o'clock at night till 6 o'clock in the morning. I will have it all cleaned up and ready to go. But I said, I only want to shoot Fridays and Saturdays. So, and I worked for a company on that road. And I said, and I know nobody's going to be there. And I said, even if they were, they can go in to the further north entrance. And the city said, yeah, go ahead and do it. So I got the permission to close the road. And then I just got a bunch of people to just come out and park their cars like it was a traffic jam and just had this zombie melee. You know, zombies attacking motorists, yanking them out of the cars, ripping them apart. And, you know, it's like, it took 3 weekends to shoot everything that was done on that road. So the first weekend was the zombies invading the traffic jam with some of the people getting pulled out of their cars, dragged and things like that. The second weekend was doing the special effects for a motorist who has her throat ripped out by a zombie, and then doing some pickups that I wanted. And then the third weekend was Brian and I, as the actors in the movie, the two characters, come upon the traffic jam and get out to see if, like, how bad it is. And then we end up running into the undead, and we try to run back to my car, and they're kind of gaining on us. So we both had guns, and we just start shooting wildly and realizing that it's not doing it because we're not expert shots like some of these folks in zombie movies where they can pick you, you know, right off the bat. So we're just firing. And then, you know, it's like, I get the car. I left it running, throw the car in reverse and jam on the gas pedal to back up. And I was just caught in the moment, and we're flying backwards at probably like 30, 40 miles an hour. And I flung the wheel around. And just as I did, the car stopped 5 feet short of hitting a telephone pole. And it was just like, but I still took off. Like, I saw the pole, threw it in drive, stomped on the gas, and still took off. And I came back, and the camera operators were like, do you know how close you came to that pole? I was like, yeah, I saw it. And they were like, why didn't you find somebody that could stunt drive for you? And I said, it's my car, and if it's going to get wrecked, I'm the one that's doing it. So that was pretty much it. But then, yeah, it took like a year to shoot that. And then I submitted it to a bunch of film festivals. Some basically, you know, told me to go pound sand because the quality wasn't great. But Fright Night Film Festival was doing its inaugural year in 2006. And they accepted the film. I drove all the way to Louisville, Kentucky, right after having heart surgery, like 3 weeks prior to it. And since it was an inaugural event, not a lot of people showed up, but it was enough for them to have another event the following year. They screened the movie, the people that were judging it, because there were 14 other zombie films. And when they gave out the awards that night, Ken Daniels, who was the owner of the festival, director of the festival, he's, you know, and he announced that we won for best zombie film. And I was like, I was literally floored. And I said, you know, what was the, and I had some other friends who had put in zombie films in the fest. And he said, you won this award specifically because of that traffic jam you staged. He said, what you pulled off $10,000 budget, he said, is just, I've never seen that in any of the independent films that were submitted. And I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, thanks. So, and then the other festival that I got something from was a one-time only fest called the It Came From Lake Michigan in Racine, Wisconsin. And that festival was shady. The owner of the festival literally was sending his daughter around to all the celebrities and the vendors to get them to kick in more money because he didn't have enough money to pay for the venue and all of the airline tickets and everything. So, you know, it's like, I was like, send your kid. This is supposed to be on you, dude. And so he never, I think he had one more festival the next year. And, I didn't attend, but the year I did go in 06, I met these guys out of Wisconsin called Angry Young Men Limited, LTD. And they had this thing called the Night of the Living Dead Puppet Show. And they would do Night of the Living Dead, a reenactment with puppets. And, you know, it was like, imagine Jim Henson, obviously at a much lower budget, you know, acting out things in, you know, Night of the Living Dead, but adding little bits of comedic elements to it, or like, you know, when a zombie gets shot in the head and they shoot the puppet, they have red ribbons that somebody will pull out of the puppet's head, like its brain splattering against, and they'll just keep pulling it. These guys were so creative that I loved their work so much that when I got the DVD deal for Deadlands the Rising, they had a filmed version of their show. And I got permission from them. I said, hey, I want to put it on the DVD as extras. And they were like, really? I said, dude, I love this. I said, even if people don't like it, it still deserves to be seen. You know, and so I released, along with my film and a bunch of extras, I put their short film on mine, their puppet show. And I also did it for another guy out of England that I was good friends with named Nick Thompson. Because he did this short film called I Am Zombie Man about a zombie who was this star, and he became addicted to bone ash, which is supposed to be a substitute for cocaine, and his life spiraled out of control, and he was no longer a celebrity. He was just kind of meandering around. So, hilarious. And I said to Nick, I said, can you send me a coded version of that in NTSC, which is the American codec? And he's like, yeah, why? And I said, I'm going to put it on my DVD as extras. And my distributor at the time wasn't happy about it. But I said, look, I got a movie that's an hour and 7 minutes, right? I said, it's not a short. It's not a full feature. I said, yeah, I have the director's commentary. I've got some behind-the-scenes stuff. I said, trust me, watch these videos, and they will fit in perfectly as bonus material. So it was J.R. Bookwalter. He looked at him and he said, okay, fine. And as far as I know, to this day, and you may have to talk to J.R. Bookwalter to confirm it, Deadlands the Rising was the most successful title he ever released from his Tempe Video / Splatter Rampage label. So that's what he, but that was like back in 2010, just before I put Deadlands 2 out. And, you know, he was doing a podcast, and that's where I heard it. And then I reached out to him, and he called me, and he said, yeah, he says, yours is actually the best-selling title I've had. And he says, he says, I've done 7 pressings. I was like, oh, damn. So,
nice.
That was kind of on. So.
Nice. Nice segue, too. Getting to Deadlands 2, Trapped, which was 2008, I think. And you did a lot on that one, too. Editor, composer, executive producer, writer, director, actor, visual effects. So tell us a little bit about that. And not that I'm trying to, like, rush you. I'm just letting you know that the time passes a lot quicker than people realize. We're down to like 34 minutes, which is actually plenty of time, but I'm just letting you know that it's about half over now.
I'm watching the time on my laptop that I have opened. Deadlands 2 was, I was not extremely happy with the way Deadlands the Rising came out. And I said, I was talking to Brian, because we both worked in the biotech industry. You know, so we did vaccine research for cancer, you know, flu vaccines and pneumonia vaccines, things like that. And I was telling him, he worked at a different company than I did, but I said, dude, I think I can do better. And I said, I think I can do better on less money. And he was like, huh? I said, well, I said, I just got my bonus from work and it's about $6,000. I said, I want to do another zombie film. And I said, I want to change the style that I did it. And he was like, okay. So I got access to, I think it was 10 Theater Cineplex in Hagerstown, Maryland. And I went to I premiered Deadlands, the Rising there locally, and it did really well. It made the theater money, you know, they were extremely happy because like opening night in a 500 seat auditorium, they sold 390 seats. And then they ran it for a week and, you know, between the Hagerstown newspapers and stuff, it garnered enough that the theater was like, oh, you know, was there anything you could do? I said, yeah, you can let me use your movie theater to film another zombie movie. And the idea behind it was to do a direct homage to, Return of the Living Dead and Demons. There was that Dario Argento produced movie from, I think it was 85 or 86. And, so they agreed and I went to work the one day and our intranet was out. So I couldn't get anything accomplished so I said, well, screw it. I'm here. I'm getting paid. I'll just write the script for the movie. And I sat down and wrote 80 pages in 8 hours. And that was the first draft. And I went back and toned it up a little, you know, tightened it up a little bit. And we started shooting like a month later. There's this guy, Christian Rom Logan, who was a master's film student at Howard University. And we ran into each other and I said, you know, I was telling him what I'm doing. And he's like, well, you know, I could use something for my thesis. I was like, dude, it's a zombie horror film. You know, I said, I'm all for it. And he said, what do you need? I said, I need a cinematographer. I need somebody that can set the shots, set the camera tone to make it look like a 1980s, you know, video nasty. And he's like, no problem. So he worked on the film we shot 4 months on weekends and he did about 75% of it. We movie done this time. I didn't cast myself. I found local actors who were a lot better than I could be. And when I cast each actor, I based it on, well, not just their acting ability, but who did they look like from the movies that I grew up with. So there was this girl, Ashley Young. She looked like a Judith O'Day from Night of the Living Dead. There was this guy, Joe Durbin, kind of looked like Tom Matthews from Return of the Living Dead. And there was this guy, Christopher Clark, who happened to play a zombie in my previous film. And Chris and I had some great conversations on set. And I just had him in mind. And I said, well, you're the theater manager. So, and then everybody else I filled out with other local actors. And we got the movie done. We started in September of 2007. And we took off the cold months, you know, so November, December, January, February. We resumed filming in March, and I wrapped filming the weekend before the world premiere of the movie at the cinema we shot it at. So what basically everybody got was a rough work print, you know, where the sound mix was kind of all over the place. And then it was received better. I mean, it had its flaws, but so then I spent the next 3 months tweaking it and getting it where it needed to be. And I submitted it to a lot more festivals. And Fright Night was I resubmitted to again. And the other one was the Queens International Film Festival in Queens, New York. I never thought in a million years they would accept it. And they did. And we had a mid-screening on a Friday night, and I was surprised at how many people were in the auditorium. I was like, oh. So when I went up, you know, they introduced it. I said, all right, I'm Gary. I'm the director. I said, I hope you guys like B movies, because I say this is so B that it kind of rates somewhere around a Z in the alphabet scale. And we played it, and, you know, judging by the audience, I saw there was things I could fix, but in the end, everybody was like, damn, you know, that looked pretty good. They go, what'd you spend on it? And I said, $5,800. And they were like, no way. And I said, I have the entire spreadsheet I can give you in my back pocket. Wow. And so, yeah. And then I went home from the festival and I spent the holidays working on another edit. And then I finally got the edit complete, and it kind of worked great because Fright Night, somehow the just before the screening in 2009, the disc got damaged that they had. And I said to Ken Daniels, I said, well, Ken, I've recut the film a little bit here and there. So, and he said, is it the same film? And I said, well, essentially, yeah. I said, it's just got a tighter edit, better sound mix. You know, I said, there's a few scenes I took out, few things I added in, but I said, I don't have that work print anymore. I saved over it like an idiot. And he was just like, so I said, look, if you want to take it out of competition, that's fine. He's like, well, how quick can you get here? And I said, well, I'm leaving a day early. So I left a day early. He gave the disc to the judges, I guess. And they made the decision that it was essentially so close to the original submission that they just let it roll. And then that one had a great attendance. And the next thing I know, we're at the awards ceremony Saturday night. And if you ever notice when you know something's coming your way, you can just sense from the words people use.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You started talking, and then they said, they go, we get a lot of zombie films. And he said, and I'm not saying that any filmmaker doesn't put their heart into what they're doing. And he said, this guy won in 2006, and I'm sitting there with, like, I had one of my friends with me and one of the producers, and they were just like, didn't you win this in 2006? And I said, yeah. And so, you know, they said Deadland won for best zombie film again. And I was like, wow, okay, you know. So now I've gotten the title twice from Fright Night Film Fest.
Wow.
And it was fun. And then after that, I signed a deal with Anthem Pictures out of Los Angeles to distribute it. And that's where I learned firsthand that I never would deal with a Hollywood studio on a distribution deal without money up front.
Yeah. Yeah, understandable.
Yeah, they were so shady because this film, Anthem Pictures had some kind of label agreement with Warner Brothers. So the film comes out with a WEA, Warner Electric Atlantic, catalog number. So it's getting tracked by Billboard and all the other ones. And so I look at the sales the first week, and I'm like sitting there going, 45,000 copies. And I'm like, okay, so they sell them at 10 bucks a disc. I'm supposed to get 50%. So, all right, that should be a nice thing. Cause I, you know, wanted to share any proceeds with the actors. And,
right.
First statement, and the film's like $100,000 in the hole. And I was like, well, where is this $100,000 coming from? They were like, oh, well, for us to author a DVD. I said, it don't cost $100,000 to author a DVD. I said, hell, the menu I made for my homemade ones is nicer looking than what you did. And you know, I said, you didn't even include half the special features I sent along. So we got into a big dispute, and I had a friend who was a lawyer, and I had them reach out and say that I wanted to come to LA and audit the books. And so they started making up excuses, and I said, okay, well, if you want to make it up to me, I said, the HD DVD Blu-ray war was going on at the time, and HD DVD was about to lose. Well, it had already lost at this point. And I said, you want to make it up to me? I said, I want you to really release Deadlands 2 on HD DVD. They go, it's a dead format. I said, I don't care. I said, it'll sell enough copies because there's those of us that support HD DVD. I was one of them. And I said, it'll sell. So after hounding them and telling them, I said, do you want me to go through the books? And I said, and on this, I get everything, you know, blah, blah, blah. So they did, I don't know, they ended up doing them not, they were supposed to be pressed and they didn't end up coming out pressed. They were burned, and that ticked me off, but it had a you know, official catalog number. It was, but there was, I forget how many copies. It wasn't a lot. I think we only did 1,000, very limited production, but yeah, at HD DVD died in May of 2008, and Deadlands 2 came out in July 2010. So 2 years after the format died, and it became one of the most talked about things on the internet. And some of my filmmaking friends there would go, that was a genius marketing move. And I said, I know, because
yeah,
it wasn't that the film was being put on a dead format, which was kind of fitting since it is a zombie film. But the press I knew it would generate because of it being put on HD DVD and not Blu-ray, was more than, I mean, you couldn't type in Deadlands 2 Trapped or my name into Google without it coming up about the HD DVD release. So, you know, it was, you know, it did okay. It's, in fact, I think, you know, I see copies floating around on eBay every now and then because I signed the artwork on every single one of them. And I've seen some sell as high as $400 and some of them go as cheap as like, you know, 20 bucks. So it's like one of those rare items.
Well, yeah. Yeah. When something's rare, people want it.
Yeah.
Sometimes they want it, even if they're not even really interested, they just want it because it's something rare.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm the same way. I have, you know, when the Halloween remake came out in 2018, the new movie, whatever you want to call it, you know, I bought the Blu-ray day and date. You know, I went to the theaters to see it, and when it came out, I bought the Blu-ray. I got the 4K edition. And then I happened to be in a Best Buy like a year later, and I look over, and there's a Steelbook edition. And then I see Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, The World's End, a whole bunch of films. The next thing I know, I was only supposed to go in there to get one thing, and I came out with like $400 worth of Steelbook Blu-rays. So I know exactly how that is. And you know, the sad thing is I haven't opened a single one of them. They're still sealed. So, but
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, that's just kind of the story behind those movies. But one of the things I've always said, and I think you interviewed one of the guys I worked with on those movies, Jason Dizell.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and you know, he was enamored by the process. And I said, Jason, I said, if you want to make your own movie, just go ahead and do it. And I said, nobody's going to hand it to you on a platter. I said, but just be prepared. So I'm working a normal job. I'm staying up for, you know, anywhere from 30 to 48 hours over the weekend and then trying to recoup enough to be functional for Monday at work and rinse and repeating that. So by the time I finished Deadlands 2, I was so burned out. I was just like, okay, I don't want to do more movie stuff for a while. And then 3 years later, here comes All in the Game. So, and that was just something I just wanted to do, a gangster film, because I was really into HBO's The Wire at the time. Got a few guys together that I met at other festivals, and some of them actually were in The Wire. And I just said, hey, this is what I want to do, blah, 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 blah. And they were like, yeah, we're down. I was like, okay, cool. So we shot that movie in 11 days on
wow.
1,700. So, and to this day, it is still stocked on the shelf at the Best Buy in Compton, California.
Wow.
Yeah, because it was all over the place. Like, when it came out, I had a new distributor this time who was directly linked with Warner Brothers, but, you know, they were called Eyes Open Media. And they had access to all of Warner Brothers' distribution channels. And the next thing you know, I started getting the email alerts about the movie coming out. And I'm sitting there going, oh, wow, okay, this is cool. So I went to the local Best Buy on my lunch break, and I'm expecting to find one copy, you know, on the shelf, and there was 12. I'm like, what?
Wow.
And people were actually coming up, and they were grabbing copies, and they'd see the main actor, Micaiah Jones, on the front cover, and they were like, what do you think? And I said, I can tell you a lot about this movie. And, you know, so I said, but, you know, it's up to you. You do your thing. Because I didn't want to kind of pimp my own stuff and then have them be disappointed afterwards. I said, look, I can tell you this. It's a low-budget movie. So, I mean, really low-budget. And I said, it's, you know, set in Baltimore, you know, and obviously we were in Baltimore when I found the copy. And, you know, and it went from there. So, and then I moved to Philadelphia not too long after. Happened to walk into a Best Buy and just started walking down the aisle and found Deadlands 1, Deadlands 2, and All in the Game on the shelves. And I was like, damn. So.
Wow.
Then it's Redbox. That's the one that shocked me, is the distributor, Larry Croyle, for Eyes Open Entertainment, got it into Redbox. And right then and there, everybody that was in the movie going, dude, we're in Redbox. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, no, don't you understand? We're in Redbox. And I'm like, no, I get it. I said, the cast was so ecstatic. And I'm sitting there going, I didn't know how to feel, because Redbox was new at the time. And I didn't like the idea of, you know, renting a movie at a vending machine. I wanted Blockbusters to come back. And, you know, everybody was extremely happy, you know, but the deal I had with that distributor, just, it didn't pay in a lot in royalties. So the first check that we received was pretty big. So I split it evenly with all the actors and people on the film. And then after that, the royalties only came once a year. And, you know, they were only giving me 20%. But they have the movies for life, so they can do whatever they want with them as part of the agreement. I mean, I still hold the copyrights, but they can distribute out of it. And, you know, I got an email from the one guy at their studio. He said, what do you think about us redoing Deadlands the Rising? And I was like, I don't know. I said, you want to do it? Go ahead and do it. I said, I don't really care. And so they wanted to re-release Deadlands the Rising. And they changed the title. It's Zombie Massacre, something. I don't know what the hell it was. Deadlands 2 also got re-released with a new title, and it was called Zombie Massacre Army of the Dead. And I felt bad because Zack Snyder had been trying to get Army of the Dead made since the Dawn of the Dead remake. So, you know, and I actually still talking to him here and there in email. I'm like, dude, if you find my movie got released with Army of the Dead title, that wasn't me. That was the distributor. And I tried to get him to back off, you know, but I never heard anything upsetting about him. And then obviously he didn't get to make Army of the Dead until, 2019, and it only came out this year. So, you know, and that was a project he had a lot of passion for. So I don't know if it turned out the way he wanted, but I liked it.
Well, that was one of the films that you told me you wanted to talk about was Army of the Dead. Was there anything else you wanted to say about Halloween Kills?
Oh, Halloween, I love the 2018 movie. I thought it was so good. Fit so well into the John Carpenter universe.
Mm-hmm.
And Halloween, I was like so hyped for, and I don't hate it. I just feel let down. Like, I don't know. It's the whole thing with Evil Dies Tonight and everybody running around like the pitchfork people in Frankenstein just kind of ruined it. And then, you know, I kind of liked the idea of Anthony Michael Hall being cast until I saw his performance. And oh, that was money wasted. it was definitely brutal. I'll give it that. That was like when, in the beginning, spoiler alert, guys, when Michael goes to that house down the road from Jamie Lee Curtis's and she attacks that family and what he does to that guy, you know, just with every knife off the wall, I was like, damn.
Yeah.
I was like, somebody's in a mood. So, but I didn't go to the theaters to see that. I actually watched it on my laptop through Peacock. Because our theaters up here they're claiming they're doing social distancing and they're sanitizing the theater after every screening. They're not. And I live in Pennsylvania, a lot of people don't believe in the COVID-19 and don't believe in the vaccine, don't believe in the mask, things like that. So I'm like, yeah, fuck that.
There's some of those in every state because we've got some here in Ohio that they don't want to wear their mask. They don't want to get the vaccine. But then what kills me is just like what you hear on the news, that they don't believe in the vaccine, but yet when they get COVID and go into the hospital, the first thing they start begging for is the vaccine.
Yeah, and that's actually true because, as I said, I work in biotechnology. So I've worked on with some of the companies that developed this, and I saw this coming. I literally saw this coming because the same thing happened with H1N1 in 2009. Because I worked for a company that developed H1N1 vaccine, and people were freaking out that, oh, it hadn't been tested and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, H1N1 is a flu. I said, it's built on the same platform/principle as the flu vaccine. They were like, yeah, but the flu vaccine through testing, blah, blah, you know, when they first developed it. And I said, it did, but you do realize that every year, they change the strain that they're trying to protect you against. And people are like, huh? And so I said, okay, we'll say there's 10 flus, right? And they're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, blah, blah, blah. I said, if in 2000, this was like 2009, I said, 2009, they're treating for influenza A and influenza E. And they were like, okay, so well, next year, it's not going to be the same strains. They're going to see what strains are prevalent as it starts taking effect. And then they'll start gearing up the vaccine for those strains. And they were like, so you're saying, I said, yeah, they re-engineer the vaccine every single year and they don't have to retest it because the theory behind the vaccine and all the testing stays the same. They're just changing the strain. The problem with the COVID-19 vaccine is that it's built on new technology. And because they had to do emergency use testing, you know, accelerated clinical trials, I can see where people are nervous, but, you know, every drug is going to give somebody a side effect. I've worked on enough cancer treatments and, you know, stuff, infant RSV and things of that nature, that, you know, there's going to be people that have good reactions and there's people that have bad reactions. And, you know, it's just not the end of the world. But you got to look at it as like, but what gets me about these people is these people will sit there and claim, I'll take a bullet for my country. I said, yeah, you won't take a shot in the arm for your neighbor. So I was like kind of hypocritical. But I, you know, when I saw the hospital stories like you mentioned, I stopped caring. I lost all compassion for the skeptics. So, and I have some in my own family. And they'll, like, you know, they'll call me up and they're like, oh, you know, so-and-so got COVID. What can we do? And I was like, I don't know, go order a casket. And they were like, why would you say that? And I'm like, well, they're overweight. They have diabetes. I'm going through, like, you know, the medical history I was aware of. I said, if they come out of it, they're going to be lucky. I said, you should have got vaccinated. Well, I was just fake and blah, 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 fake news. And I'm like, okay, goodbye, click. And that family member passed away, and then they called me and said, are you coming to the funeral? I said, nope. I said, that's too much stupidity to take in even at a funeral. And that's – so, I mean, hey, it's your choice. You don't want to get the vaccine. Rock on with your bad self, but don't come crying when you get sick. You did it to yourself.
Right. Well, and that's what they do, though. They go in there, and they'll be like, oh, get me the vaccine. I'm like, no, the vaccine isn't a cure. Yet now that you have COVID, you have to wait until after you have recovered from it or died from it before you can get the vaccine. They don't understand that. They have to wait now. But no, they insist on getting the vaccine. Well, it's not going to do you any good.
Yeah, no, I've said the... You know, like I said, I have family, mostly on my mother's side. That's where all the rednecks kind of congregate. And, you know, they're all right-wing, crazy, you know, funky folks. And, here comes Mike. Are you naked? Oh, my God. Say hi.
Hi.
Why? Those that are wondering, my six-year-old son Jackson just walked into the room, and he's handing me his PlayStation remote. And what are you eating? A dryer sheet. Why? Can you go to the drawer? Anyways, but yeah, no, I have no sympathy for the anti-vaxxers anymore, especially when they get to the stage when they're in the hospital and they're begging the nurse for it. And... you know, it's gotten me in Facebook jail quite a bit because, you know, these people will be crying on Facebook. Oh, you know, they wouldn't give them the vaccine. I'm like, you can't get the vaccine. That's it. You're done. You're finished. Hey, Jackie Doodle, you want some gummy bears? All right. Well, come here.
People are nuts. But, told people, the ones that do all the complaining, the anti-vaxxers, I've gotten people mad at me, too, because I said, have you ever heard of polio? Because some of these people were younger. And they said, no. And I said, and do you know why? Why? Vaccines.
I've used the small.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just, what you're saying, yeah, I've done the same thing, but I've used smallpox as the example. I figured maybe a parent or a grandparent old enough that they still have the indentation in their arm. You know, my mom had that. So, it's like, to me, it's like these people are stuck on stupid and I'm just done dealing with stupid. I can't do it anymore. And I'm like, you know what? If I could physically come up with a Darwin Award to give to you, I hand it to you right now because you're definitely earned it. So they like, well, what's a Darwin Award? And I like Google it. So
well, I'm 61, and so I'm just old enough to have known people when I was a child that had polio before the vaccines became, you know, mandatory to go to school. You couldn't go to school without the polio vaccine. And it was just terrible. These kids that had polio.
Isn't that the same with chicken pox, measles, and they're all required vaccines? it's been 45.
They have a way of getting around them. But back in the old days, they didn't have that. They didn't let you get around it. If you didn't get the vaccines that were required, you didn't get to go to public school. You had to go to a private school.
Yeah, I remember
that.
That
was a requirement.
Like with my son, you know, we had to get his.
Yeah, what's up?
Well, we're getting close to the end anyway, so we're down to like 3.5 minutes. So I was going to let you say whatever you wanted to say in the last 3 minutes.
I was going to say thank you for having me on tonight and letting me dominate most of the show because I don't know when to shut up. but I appreciate the time you gave me tonight, and I hope it was entertaining to your listeners and by the way, anybody that wants to watch Deadlands the Rising or Deadlands 2, I uploaded them to YouTube so you can watch them for free. So
wow. You hear that, people? Free.
Yeah, and you get three versions of Deadlands 2. The work print, the alternate cut, and the unrated director's cut. So there's actually the differences are not that, you know.
Well, one thing that I wanted to say quickly, I wanted to say it, like, talk a little bit more about it, but since we don't have time now, I just wanted to mention it, that it's an upcoming, at least according to IMDb, that you announced that you're going to do Deadlands 3, The Last Stand. So that will be something that people can have to look forward to after they watch the first two.
I've been working on that for 13 years. I almost feel like Zack Snyder with Army of the Dead. It's starting and it's stopping. I've had New Line Cinema, Universal, Warner Brothers, because it was basically taking the original Deadlands concept and then covering that in the first 10 minutes of the movie and then kind of then switching gears to the Walking Dead type universe. And they do stupid things like the executives are like, well, we need a sex scene here. And I'm like, why? And they're like, well, you know, because these two, you can tell they have sexual tension. And I was like, okay, but there's zombies breaking into the compound. I don't think that sex is the first thing on their mind. And they were like, sex and nudity sell. And I'm like, yeah, no, I proved that with my first film. I said, my low budget distributor said the same thing. And I said, and it was his best selling title and it had no nudity in it. And when I made the second film, I found a stripper with the worst boob job I have ever seen just to put her in the film so that I could give the distributors my middle finger to say, I don't want to put nudity in just for the sake of nudity. So I found somebody with a bad boob job and said, there you go. I just fought left and right, left and right. Because Zombieland did well, and then Columbia Pictures had reached out, and it just, you know, when they brought up the sex thing, I said, I'm done. I said, that's it. I'm done.
Yeah, too bad we don't have time for me to say what I think about all that, but my listeners already kind of know. But we've only got like 30 seconds, so I do want to thank you for being on the show, and maybe you can come back on another time and talk about some of your other films that we didn't get to tonight. So thank you very much. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, that'd be great. Thank you for the extension of the invite.
Okay. All right. Well, have a good night. Thanks again.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, bye.
Bye.